He left the library at midnight on Wednesday, after billing Barks for 18 hours, six the day before. He added two more early Thursday morning as he polished up the 15-page memo and rehearsed his 10-minute presentation to Peckham and a team of senior associates. At precisely 7:30, he approached the partner's door and saw that it was closed. "He's expecting me at 7:30, he said politely to a secretary. "I'll let him know," she said, without making a move toward the phone. 5 minutes passed as Kyle tried to settle his nerves and appear calm. He had a knot in his stomach, and there was sweat around his collar. Why? He kept asking himself. It's just a brief presentation before a friendly audience. We're on the same team, right? 10 minutes. 15. He could hear voices in Peckham's office. Finally, the door was opened by one of the associates, and Kyle walked in. Peckham appeared surprised to see him. "Oh, yes, Kyle, I forgot," he said, snapping his fingers and frowning. "I should have emailed. The hearing's been postponed. You're off the hook. Keep the memo, I might need it later." Kyle's mouth fell open, and he glanced around. Two associates were huddled over a small work table, papers everywhere, and two more were seated near the desk. All four seemed to be amused. The false deadline. Kyle, of course, had heard of this little maneuver. The hapless associate is run through the grinder to produce a useless memo or brief that is time-sensitive but will never be used. But the client will nonetheless get billed and will pay, so even though the research is not needed, it is at least profitable. Kyle had heard of the false deadline, but didn't see this one coming. Sure, no problem, he said, backtracking. Thanks, Peckham said as he flipped the page of another document. See you later. Sure. Kyle was at the door when Peckham asked, Say, Kyle, where's the best place for Barks to try the case? Nebraska, Fillmore County, Kyle said eagerly. Two of the associates laughed out loud, and the other two were highly entertained. One of them said, Nebraska? No one tries cases in Nebraska. Thanks, Kyle, Peckham said, patronizing. Nice work. And please get out of here. For $200,000 a year, plus treats, the job would naturally have its moments of humiliation. You're getting paid for this, Kyle kept repeating as he slowly made his way up the stairs. Take it in stride. Be tough. Happens to everyone. Back in the dungeon, he managed to smile. When Dale asked, How did it go? He said, It's hard to say. At the far end of the room, two associates were plowing through mortgage files. Kyle nodded at them, then parked himself near Dale, arranged his pen, legal pad, and firm phone. He opened a box, removed a file, and re-entered the world of Placid Mortgage. It was known territory, and he felt oddly safe there. He would not be harmed or humiliated. A long career as a document reviewer would no doubt be dull, but it would also be much less hazardous than that of a litigator. Chapter 17. When Kyle left the office late Friday afternoon, he considered his first week to be a success, though a dismal one. He billed Placid 30 hours and Barks Biomed 26, and though virtually all of this valuable time would eventually mean little to either client, he wasn't paid to worry about such things. He was there to do one thing, bill. If he kept up the pace and managed only 50 hours a week, he would hit $2,500 for the year, a high number for a first year and one that would catch the attention of the higher-ups. For the week, Tabor the Gunner billed 50 hours, Dale 44, Tim Reynolds 43. It was amazing how consumed they were with the clock after only 5 days on the job. He walked to his apartment, changed into jeans, stuffed a phone in each pocket, and headed for the ballpark. The Mets were at home against the Pirates, who were already guaranteed another losing season. With 17 games to go, the Mets were in first place, 2 games ahead of the Phillies, and primed for another choke in the stretch. Kyle had paid cash for 2 tickets, sold by a broker recommended by a paralegal at the firm. As he made his way to Shea Stadium, he picked up his surveillance as it was picking up him. His seat was 15 rows behind the third base dugout. The night was hot. The Mets were in first. The place was packed. He timed his entrance perfectly and sat down just as the first pitch was thrown in the bottom of the first. To his right was a young boy holding a baseball glove and eating ice cream. To his left was a real fan with a Mets cap, Mets jersey, blue and orange sweatbands, even goofy Mets eyeglasses. Under the cap and behind the glasses was Joey Bernardo, who had spent his entire life in Pittsburgh and hated the Mets almost as much as he hated the Phillies. "Do not acknowledge me," Kyle said as he watched the field. "Don't worry. Right now I hate your guts. And I hate the Mets almost as much as I hate you." "Thanks. I like the glasses." "Can I take them off? I can't see a damn thing." "No." They were talking out of the corners of their mouths, just loud enough to hear each other. Shea was alive with every pitch, and there was little chance of being overheard. Joey took a sip of a tall beer. "Are they really following you?" "Oh, yes. Every day, everywhere."
"Do they know that you know?"
"I don't think so."
"But why?"
"Basic espionage tradecraft."
"Of course."
"Information is crucial. The more they watch and listen, the more they know about me. If they know what I eat, drink, wear, watch, listen to, and who I talk to and hang out with, and where I like to shop and browse and sneak away to, then they might one day be able to use it all to their advantage. Sounds pretty dull to you and me, but not to these guys." More beer as Joey absorbed this. A ball bounced off the left field wall, scoring a run, and the crowd was on its feet. Kyle and Joey acted like all the other fans. When things had settled down, Kyle continued. "For example, I found this wonderful little store in Midtown that sells all sorts of spy gadgets. Tiny cameras, hidden mics, phone tapping devices, and some high-tech stuff that the military has left behind. It's run by a couple of misfits who claim to be ex-CIA, but then people who are really ex-CIA don't talk about it. I found the store online, at the office, not at the apartment, and I've been there twice when I was able to shake surveillance. I might need the store one day, but if the goons knew I had discovered the place, they would really be interested."
"This is too weird."
A lady in front of Joey turned around and offered a curious glance. They did not speak for the rest of the first inning.
"How about the report on Elaine?" Joey whispered.
"It worries me."
"So what's next?"
"I think you should go see her."
"No way."
"It's easy. Just bump into her and see what happens."
"Right. Drive to Scranton, a town I can't recall seeing in the past 10 years. Somehow find her, recognize her, assume she'll recognize me, then what? Have a friendly little chat about the last time we were together? Have a laugh for old time's sake? Hell, Kyle, she accused me of rape."
"Shh," Kyle hissed softly. The word rape sort of hung in the thick air, but no one reacted to it.
"Sorry," Joey whispered, and they watched the game for a long time.
A ferocious argument erupted at first base after a close call, and all 50,000 fans had an opinion. In the roar, Kyle said, "It would be an interesting meeting, to see how she reacts. Will she talk to you? Is she bitter, angry, full of vengeance? You take the high road and say that the encounter has always troubled you, that you want to talk about it. See if she'll meet you for a drink and a serious conversation. You're not going to admit anything. You just want to see how she feels. Maybe you want closure. What's there to lose?"
"What if she recognizes me, pulls out a gun, and bam?"
"I'll take care of Blair." Kyle managed this with a grin, though the thought of spending any more time with Joey's girl was not pleasant.
"Thanks. She's pregnant, you know. Thanks for asking."
"Why is she pregnant?"
"Basic biology, but we're both surprised."
"Congratulations, Daddy."
"Getting married is one thing, but I'm not so sure about this fatherhood business."
"I thought her career was at full throttle."
"Yep, me too. She said she was on the pill, but I don't know."
This was not a topic Kyle wanted to explore. The more they talked, the easier conversation became, and that was not wise. "I'm going to the restroom," Kyle said.
"Bring me a beer."
"No, I don't know you, remember?"
"Come on, Kyle, you think someone here is watching you?"
"With binoculars, at least two of them. They followed me here, probably bought tickets from a scalper outside the gates, and now they're watching."
"But why?"
"Basic surveillance, Joey. I'm a valuable asset, yet they don't trust me.
You should read some spy novels.
That's your problem. Too much fiction.
Kyle took his time between innings. He visited the men's room, then bought a diet soda and peanuts. When he returned to his seat, he struck up a conversation with the kid on his right, a loyal Met fan who knew every player and all their stats. His father was in advertising, and Kyle managed to seem intrigued with that career. He cracked peanuts, scattered the hulls at his feet, and ignored Joey for a long time. Joey, still half-blinded by the oversized Met's eyeglasses, suffered in silence. The Pirates were down 4 runs after 4 innings, and he was ready to leave. Kyle eventually reshifted and began studying the scoreboard in center field.
"Any word from Baxter?" he said without moving his jaws.
"Nothing. I think they've locked him in a cave."
"I know the feeling. I've been in a dungeon all week."
"I don't want to hear it. For the money they're paying you, no complaints."
"Okay, okay. They know that he's in rehab, and they probably know where he is," Kyle said as a long fly ball was caught on the warning track.
"They?"
"The goons. Their leader told me last week that he's in rehab."
"How often do you meet with this guy?"
"Too often."
"Have you handed over any secrets?"
"Nope, I have not been compromised."
Joey sipped his beer, swallowed slowly, and with the cup in front of his mouth said,
"If they know about Baxter, are they keeping tabs on me?"
"It's possible. Play it safe. Vary your movements. Be careful with all correspondence."
"Oh, this is just great."
"My apartment is full of cameras and mics. They come and go when they wish. I don't have an alarm system, don't want one, but I know when they've been there. Everything I do in my apartment is subject to being watched and recorded. But they don't know that I know, so I give them nothing of consequence."
"So you're outsmarting these professional intelligence agents?"
"I think so." Another long pause in the conversation as the Pirates changed pitchers again.
"What's the end game, Kyle?"
"I don't have one. I'm taking small, safe steps. Next, we make contact with a girl and see how bad things are there."
"Pretty bad, I'd guess."
"Let's see."
Kyle reached for his vibrating pocket and yanked out the firm phone. He scrolled down, found the message, and felt like cursing.
"What is it?"
Joey asked, trying not to look at the phone.
"It's a partner. He's got a project. Wants me at the office at 7 in the morning.
"Tomorrow's Saturday, Kyle."
"Just another day at the office."
"Are these guys crazy?"
"No, just greedy."
During the 7th inning stretch, Kyle eased out of his seat and made his way to the gates. Joey stayed until the 8th, and finally he left as his beloved Pirates were losing their 90th game. Jeans were allowed on Saturdays and Sundays. The fact that there was a dress code for the weekend, however relaxed, said much about the practice of corporate law on Wall Street.
Why were they even there?
Kyle wore jeans, as did Dale, who looked spectacular in a pair of tight ones. Tim Reynolds wore starched khakis. All three were dazed at the reality of being in a small conference room on the 34th floor at 7 a.m. on the second Saturday of their fledgling careers. They joined 4 older associates, 4 young men Kyle had not had the pleasure of meeting or even seeing during his first 2 weeks on the job. Passing introductions were made, but only because they were expected. The partner who had called the meeting was nowhere to be seen. His name was Tobias Rowland, Toby behind his back, and of all the sizzling gossip Kyle had heard so far, the worst had been about Toby. Toby's stories were abundant, and very few were even remotely flattering. Yale undergrad, Columbia Law, poor kid from a rough neighborhood with a gigantic chip on his shoulder. Brilliant, ruthless, conniving, he'd made partner in only 5 years, primarily because he worked harder than the rest of the workaholics and never relaxed. His idea of time off was a 10-minute tryst with a secretary on the sofa in his office. Most secretaries were terrified of him, too frightened to complain or file suit. Some, though, found him sexy enough for a quick romp. For fun, he berated young associates, often cursing them in the foulest of language for the smallest of infractions. He intimidated the other partners because he was smarter and always better prepared. At the age of 44, he was the top producing, billing, litigator in the firm and had not lost a jury trial in 8 years. Toby was in demand by the in-house lawyers of many major corporations. A year earlier, Kyle had read and clipped an article in Fortune touting the greatness of Scully and Pershing's fanciest litigator. When Toby beckoned, you went running, albeit with a great deal of trepidation. In his place that morning was a senior associate named Bronson, who, as he explained without a trace of enthusiasm, was standing in for Mr. Rowland, who was just down the hall working on another aspect of the lawsuit at hand. He might pop in at any moment, and this prospect kept everyone wide awake. Their client was a major oil company that was about to be sued by a Dutch firm over some disputed reserves in the Gulf of Mexico. The lawsuit was expected to be filed in New Orleans, but Mr. Rowland had decided to file a preemptive lawsuit in New York. The plan was to file it first thing Monday morning. It was an ambush, a daring tactic that could backfire, the type of risky maneuver that Toby was famous for. After a few minutes of listening to a lawsuit described in terms reminiscent of the D-Day invasion, Kyle realized that his Saturday and Sunday were shot to hell and would be spent researching jurisdictional issues in the law library. He glanced at his firm phone, scrolled down through the emails, and something caught his eye. At 7:30 on a Saturday morning, the firm was sending an email to all lawyers announcing the resignation of Gavin Mead, a fourth-year associate in litigation. No details, no comments, nothing but a quiet and quick exit. "Everybody has secrets," Benny said. How did he do it? Perhaps an anonymous package mailed to someone in human resources? Affidavits, police records, the works. Poor Mead, 10 years removed from his crime and hustling through the grind at $400,000 a year, when suddenly he gets a summons to a meeting with closed doors. Bronson was rattling on about being the hub of a wooden wheel, with spokes running down and out to the 7 associates below him and several running upward to Mr. Rowland and the other litigation partners. At the hub, he, Bronson, would direct traffic between the big boys and the rookies. He would organize the work, supervise the research, and handle correspondence with the partners. Everything crossed his desk. Time was crucial. If word leaked, the Dutch firm and its lawyers might do all sorts of evil things. The nation's oil supply hung in the balance, perhaps even Western civilization. Off they went to the library. Chapter 18. After a series of phone calls that became more and more tense, a deal was finally reached. Dr. Boone and Uncle Wally acquiesced, but managed to keep one string attached. Baxter would leave early, but spend 3 nights in a halfway house in Reno before re-entry into the real world. 105 days after arriving sloppy drunk with a blood alcohol content of 0.28 and with significant residues of cocaine in his system, Baxter rode through the gates and left behind the safety of the Washoe retreat. He was squeaky clean and 10 pounds lighter, and not only had he kicked booze and drugs, he had also quit smoking. He was fit, tanned and clear-headed, and thoroughly believed he had conquered his demons and would henceforth live the sober life. He was armed for battle with the teachings of Dr. Boone and the other counselors. He had confessed his sins and surrendered to a higher power, whatever and whoever that was. At the age of 25, he was beginning a new life, and Baxter was both proud and apprehensive, even frightened. As the miles passed, he found himself more uncomfortable. His confidence was rapidly disappearing. He had failed so many times in so many ways. It was a family tradition. Was it in his DNA? An orderly drove him from the clinic in the Nightingale Mountains into Reno, a 2-hour drive in which little was said. As they approached the city, they passed a splashy billboard advertising an imported beer in a cold green bottle. The slinky young woman holding it could entice any man to do almost anything. Fear hit Baxter harder. It consumed him, and beads of sweat lined his forehead. He wanted to turn around, to run back to the clinic, where there was no alcohol and no temptations. But he said nothing. Hope Village was in a rundown section of Reno. Abandoned buildings, cheap casinos, and bars. It was the domain of Brother Manny, the founder, pastor, and leader of Hope Village. He was waiting at the curb outside the church's front door when Baxter stepped onto the hot sidewalk. He grabbed Baxter's hand and shook it violently.
Mr. Tate, may I call you Baxter?
The question suggested its own answer. He was Baxter, not Mr. Tate.
Sure,
Baxter said, his spine stiffened from this physical assault.
I'm Brother Manny, he said,
placing his thick left arm on Baxter's shoulder, completing a rather rough howdy-do.
Welcome to Hope Village.
He was about 50, Hispanic, bronze skin, gray hair pulled back tightly into a long ponytail that fell to his waist, warm eyes, big toothy smile, a small scar beside his left nostril and a larger one on his right cheek. His face was adorned with a soft white goatee that had been pampered for many years.
Another escapee from Washoe Retreat, he said with a deep, melodious voice. How is the good Dr. Boone doing up there?
Fine, Baxter said. Brother Manny's nose was about 5 inches from his. Close contact obviously did not bother him, but it made Baxter uncomfortable.
He sends his regards. A fine man. Come, I'll show you around. We have you for just 3 nights, as I understand.
That's right. They began walking slowly. Brother Manny kept one arm across Baxter's shoulders. He was a large man, with a thick barrel chest, and he wore dungarees and a white linen shirt, 2 top buttons open, with a long tail left out so that it swept behind him. Sandals, no socks. The church had once belonged to an affluent white congregation that fled to the suburbs. As Baxter shuffled through the tour, he also got the backstory. Manny Lucera had found the Lord during his second term in prison, armed robbery, the proceeds from which were meant to buy drugs for personal consumption, and upon his parole, he was led by the Spirit to Reno to start his ministry. 17 years ago, and the Lord had blessed him mightily. The church had grown and now housed a shelter for the homeless in the basement, a soup kitchen that fed anyone who showed up, a community center for the poor kids in the neighborhood, an intake center for women and children fleeing abusive men, and there were plans for an orphanage. The old buildings next door had been purchased and renovated. The complex was crawling with people, employees, volunteers, street people, and they almost bowed in deference when they saw Brother Manny. They parked themselves on a picnic table in the shade and sipped canned lemonade.
What's your drug? Manny asked.
Coke, booze, but I didn't say no to anything, Baxter admitted.
After 15 weeks of baring his soul to people who already knew everything, he did not hesitate to tell the truth.
For how long?
Started slow when I was about 14. Picked up steam as I got older. I'm 25 now, so 11 years.
Where are you from?
Pittsburgh, originally.
Background?
Privileged.
Brother Manny issued the questions and absorbed the answers with such ease that after 15 minutes together, Baxter felt as though he could chat for hours and tell him everything.
First rehab?
Second.
I did every drug you can imagine, and some you've never heard of, for 20 years. I bought, sold, smuggled, and manufactured drugs. I got knifed 4 times, shot 3, and went to prison 2 for drugs. I lost my first wife and 2 children because of drugs and alcohol. I lost my chance for an education. I lost 8 years because of prison. I almost lost my life. I know all about addictions because I've been there. I'm a certified drug and alcohol counselor, and I work with addicts every day.
Are you an addict?
Yes.
Bless you, brother.
Do you know Christ?
I guess. My mother took me to church every Christmas.
Brother Manny smiled and slowly wiggled his large rear end off the table.
Let me show you your room. It's not the Ritz, but it'll do.
The homeless shelter was a large basement room with a temporary partition dividing it, women on one side, men on the other. It was open, with rows of army surplus cots in neat lines.
Most of these people work during the day. They're not bums,
Brother Manny was saying.
They'll start drifting in around 6 p.m. Here's your room.
Near the showers, there were 2 small private rooms with nicer cots and portable fans.
Brother Manny opened the door to one and said, "You can have this one. It's for a supervisor. To get a private room, you must have a job, so you'll help with the dinner preparation. Then later, when everybody's tucked in, you'll help with security."
He uttered these definitive statements in such a way that any thought of protest was immediately cut off and out of the question. Baxter's world was spinning. He'd begun the day in the cushy confines of a 4-star rehab ranch, and done so with giddy thoughts of finally leaving. Now he was in the hot basement of an old church that was home to 52 of the poorest souls in America, and he was expected to live with them for the next 3 days, and to cook their meals and break up their fights. Baxter Tate, of the Pittsburgh Tate dynasty, bankers, blue bloods who lived in mansions handed down from one miserable generation to the next, proud and arrogant people who married into other similar clans, thus producing even shallower gene pools. How had he reached this point in his young life? Legally, he could leave any time he wanted. Hit the door, find a cab, never look back. There was no court order restraining him. Uncle Wally might be disappointed, but that would be the extent of Baxter's worries if he fled.
"Are you okay?" Brother Manny asked.
"No."
It was refreshing to be so honest.
"Take a nap. You look pale."
He couldn't sleep because of the heat. After an hour, he sneaked away and found himself roaming downtown Reno. He had a late lunch in a diner, his first burger and fries in months. He had the money to get a hotel room for a day or two, and that plan consumed him as he zigzagged through the streets. He passed and repassed the casinos. He'd never been a gambler, but every casino had a bar, didn't it? Of course, the bars were off limits, but he couldn't stomach the thought of returning to Hope Village, at least not now. At a blackjack table, he pulled out 5 $20 bills, got some green chips, and played the $5 game for a few minutes. An aging cocktail waitress swept by, asked what he wanted to drink.
"A bottle of water," he said without hesitation, then patted himself on the back.
The only other player at the table was a cowboy, black hat and all, with a bottle of beer in front of him. Baxter drank his water, played his hands, and occasionally glanced at the bottle of beer. It looked so harmless, so beautiful. When his chips had been taken by the dealer, he left the table and wandered around the casino floor. It was a dreadful place, sparsely filled with people who had no business being there, gambling with money they could not afford to lose. He walked by a sports bar, with wide screens showing old football games. The weekend's point spreads were posted. The bar was empty. He settled onto a stool and ordered water. What would Dr. Boone say about this? Not 6 hours into re-entry, and he was already at a bar. "Relax, Dr. Boone. It's just water. If I can resist the urge here at ground zero, then the next place will be easy." He sipped water and occasionally glanced at the rows of liquor bottles. Why were there so many different shapes and sizes? So many different types of spirits? One entire row was taken by flavored vodkas, delicious liquids he had consumed by the barrel back in the days when he was a drunk. Thank God those days were over. In the distance, across the floor somewhere, a siren squealed and bells erupted. A lucky slot player had hit a jackpot, and the racket was to remind everyone just how easy it was to win. The bartender filled a glass with a draft beer, then slammed it in front of Baxter.
"On the house," he proclaimed. "Super slot jackpot."
Free drinks for everyone at the bar, which was nobody but Baxter. He almost said, "Hey, pal, take it away. I don't drink anymore." But the bartender was gone. Plus, it would sound silly. How many non-drinkers sidle up to a casino bar at 3 o'clock in the afternoon? The glass was frosty, the beer ice cold. It was darker in color, and Baxter looked at the tap. Nevada Pale Ale, one he'd never tried. His mouth was dry, so he sipped water. For 105 days, he'd been hammered by Dr. Boone and the other pros at Washoe Retreat into believing that another drink would eventually lead him back to his addictions. He'd watched and listened as other patients, or guests as they were called, struggled through detox and told their stories of repeated failures. "Don't ever be fooled," they warned repeatedly. You cannot handle a single drink. Total abstinence is required.
Maybe so. Small bubbles of water formed on the glass and began to run down to the napkin under it. He was 25 years old, and he never truly believed, not even in his purest moment back at Washoe, that he would live the rest of his life without a drink. Somewhere deep down in his soul, he knew he could find the willpower to have a drink, maybe a couple, then stop for the night before things got out of hand. If he planned to drink, why not start now? The last time, he tortured himself for 14 days before breaking down. For 2 weeks, he lied to himself, and especially to his friends, about loving the life of sobriety, and every single moment he craved a drink. Why go through the misery again? The beer was getting warm. He heard the voices of his counselors. He remembered the tears and confessions of the other guests. He heard himself proclaim the gospel of the sober. I am an alcoholic, weak and powerless, in need of strength from a higher being. And they were weak, those other losers back at Washoe Retreat. But not Baxter. He could handle a few drinks because he was stronger. He rationalized that he would, under no circumstances, succumb to the romance and horror of cocaine. Nor would he indulge in hard liquor. Just a little beer, occasionally. And he might get serious about wine. No big deal. Still, he could not make himself reach forward and touch the glass. It was 18 inches away, well within his grasp, just standing there like a coiled rattler ready to kill. Then it was a luscious treat that delivered a pleasant buzz. Back and forth, evil versus good. You need to make new friends, Dr. Boone had said repeatedly, and you can't go back to your old haunts. Find some new places, new friends, new challenges, a different place to live. Well, how about this, Dr. Boone? Sitting here for the very first time in a run-down Reno casino he couldn't remember the name of. Never been here before? Ha, ha. Both hands were free. And at some point, Baxter realized his right hand was shaking slightly, and his breathing was labored and heavy. You okay, buddy? The bartender asked as he walked by. Yes. No. Baxter nodded something but couldn't speak. His eyes were locked on the glass of beer. Where was he? What was he doing? 6 hours after leaving rehab, he was in a bar brawling with himself over whether he should take another drink. He was already a loser. Look where he was. With his left hand, he reached forward, touched the glass, then slid it slowly toward him. He stopped when it was 6 inches away. He could smell the barley and hops. The glass was still cold, or cold enough. The war shifted from good versus evil to run versus stay. He almost managed to shove himself away from the bar and sprint back through the slots to the front door. Almost. Oddly, it was Keefe who helped him make the decision. Keefe was his best friend at Washoe, and Keefe was from a wealthy family that was paying for the third rehab. The first two tanked when Keefe convinced himself that a little pot was harmless. Baxter whispered to himself, if I drink this beer now, and if things turn out badly, I can always go back to Washoe, and with two failures, I'll be convinced that total abstinence is required, just like Keefe. But right now, I really want this beer. With both hands, he clasped the glass, raised it slowly, sniffing as it grew closer. He smiled when the cold glass touched his lips. The first sip of Nevada Pale Ale was the most magnificent nectar he'd ever tasted. He savored it, eyes closed, face serene. From over his right shoulder, someone yelled loudly,
"There you are, Baxter!"
He almost choked, and he almost dropped the glass. He jerked around, and there was Brother Manny, closing fast and obviously not happy.
"What are you doing?"
he demanded as he lowered a heavy hand on Baxter's shoulder and seemed ready to trade punches. Baxter wasn't sure what he was doing. He was drinking a beer, one that was definitely off limits, but he was so horrified at that moment he couldn't speak. Brother Manny delicately took the glass and slid it down the bar.
"Get rid of this,"
he growled at the bartender. Then he sat on the stool next to Baxter and moved in low until his nose was once again 5 inches away.
Listen to me, son, he said in a soft voice. I cannot make you leave this place right now. That is your decision. But if you want me to help you, then say so. I'll get you out of here, take you back to my church, make some coffee, and we'll tell some stories.
Baxter's shoulders sagged and his chin dropped. The ale was still attacking his taste buds.
This could be the most important decision of your life, Brother Manny said. Right now, at this moment, stay or go. If you stay, you'll be dead in 5 years. If you want to go, then say so, and we'll leave together.
Baxter closed his eyes and said,
I'm so weak.
Yes, but I'm not. Let me get you out of here.
Please.
Brother Manny practically lifted him off the stool, then put a thick arm around his shoulders. They slowly made their way past the slot machines and empty roulette wheels, and they were almost to the front door when Brother Manny realized that Baxter was crying. The tears made him smile. An addict must hit the bottom before he starts his climb. The pastor's office was a large, cluttered room next to the sanctuary. The secretary, Brother Manny's wife, brought them a pot of strong coffee and two mismatched mugs. Baxter sat low in an old leather sofa and sipped furiously, as if he could rinse away the taste of the beer. The tears had stopped, for now. Brother Manny sat close by on a wooden rocker, and as he talked, he moved slowly back and forth.
I was in prison in California, he was saying. The second time around, in a gang, doing worse stuff on the inside than we did on the streets. I got careless one day, got away from my turf, and the rival gang jumped me. Woke up in the prison hospital with broken bones and cuts and such. Cracked skull, terrible pain. I remember thinking death would be welcome. I was so sick of living, sick of my life, sick of the miserable person I was. I knew that if I survived, and one day got paroled again, I'd end up on the streets, playing the same game. Where I grew up, you either went to prison or you died young. Sounds very different from the way you grew up, doesn't it, Baxter?
He shrugged.
In many ways it is. In many ways it is not. My life was all about myself, much like yours. I loved the bad things, just like you. Pleasure, selfishness, pride. That was my life. And it's been yours, I suppose.
Oh, yes.
It's all sin. And it all leads to the same end. Misery, pain, destruction, ruin, then death. That's where you're headed, son. And you're in a hurry to get there.
Baxter nodded slightly.
So what happened?
I got lucky and lived. And not long afterward, I met an inmate. A career criminal who would never be eligible for parole.
And he was the gentlest, sweetest, happiest person I'd ever talked to.
Had no worries. Every day was beautiful. Life was grand. And this from a man who'd spent 15 years in max security. Through a prison ministry, he'd been exposed to the gospel of Christ. And he became a believer.
He said he was praying for me, as he prayed for a lot of the bad guys in prison. He invited me to a Bible study one night, and I listened to other inmates tell their stories and praise God for his forgiveness and love and strength and promise of eternal salvation. Imagine, a bunch of hardened criminals locked away in a rotten prison singing songs of praise to their Lord. Pretty powerful stuff. And I needed some of it. I needed forgiveness, because there were lots of sins in my past. I needed peace. Because I'd been at war my entire life. I needed love, because I hated everybody. I needed strength, because deep inside, I knew how weak I was. I needed happiness, because I'd been miserable for so long. So we prayed together, me and those bad boys who were like little lambs, and I confessed to God that I was a sinner, and that I wanted salvation through Jesus Christ. My life changed in an instant, Baxter. A change so overwhelming I still can't believe it. The Holy Spirit entered my soul, and the old Manny Lucera died. A new one was born, one whose past was forgiven, and his eternity secured. What about the drugs?
Forgotten. The power of the Holy Spirit is far greater than human desire.
I've seen it 1,000 times with addicts who try everything to quit.
Rehab clinics, state facilities, shrinks and doctors, fancy meds sold as substitutes. When you're an addict, you're powerless in the face of booze and drugs.
Strength comes from somewhere else.
For me, it comes from the power of the Holy Spirit.
I don't feel very strong right now.
You're not. Look at yourself. From Washoe Retreat to a cheap bar in a rundown casino in a few hours. That might be a record, Baxter.
I didn't want to go to that bar.
Of course not. But you did.
Why?
His voice was soft, fading. Because you've never said no.
A tear rolled down Baxter's cheek, and he wiped it with the back of his hand.
I don't want to go back to L.A.
You can't, son.
Can you help me? I'm pretty shaky here, okay? I mean, I'm really scared.
Let's pray together, Baxter.
I'll try.
Chapter 19. 6 months after the Trilon-Barton dispute went public with the filing of the lawsuit, the battleground had been defined, and the troops were in place. Both sides had filed ponderous motions designed to capture the higher ground, but so far no advantage had been gained. They were, of course, haggling over deadlines, schedules, issues, discovery, and who got to see what documents and when. With the waves of lawyers working in sync, the case was plodding along. A trial was nowhere in sight, but then it was far too early. With monthly billings to Trilon averaging $5.5 million, why push the case to a conclusion? On the other side, Barton Dynamics was paying just as much for a vigorous and gold-plated defense coordinated by the bare-knuckle litigators at AG Poe and Epps. Ape had committed 40 lawyers to the case, and, like Scully, had such a deep bench that it could send in another wave whenever necessary. The hottest issue so far was no surprise to either set of litigators. When the forced marriage of Trilon and Barton unraveled, when their clumsy joint venture blew up, there had been a virtual slugfest for the documents. Hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of documents had been generated during the development of the B-10 hypersonic bomber. Researchers employed by Trilon grabbed all the documents they could. Researchers for Barton did the same. Software was routed and rerouted, and some of it was destroyed. Hardware controlled by one company found its way to the other. Thousands of secured files disappeared. Crates of printed documents were hoarded and hidden. And throughout the melee, each company accused the other of lying, espionage, outright thievery. When the dust settled, neither knew exactly what the other possessed. Because of the super-sensitive nature of the research, the Pentagon watched in horror as the two companies behaved outrageously. The Pentagon, as well as several intelligence agencies, leaned heavily on Trilon and Barton to keep their dirty laundry private, but they were ultimately not successful. The fight was now controlled by the lawyers and the courts. A major task for Mr. Wilson Rush and his Scully and Pershing team was to accumulate, index, copy, and store all documents in the possession of Trilon. A warehouse was leased in Wilmington, North Carolina, about a mile from the Trilon testing facility where most of the B-10 research had taken place. After it was leased, it was completely renovated and made fire, wind, and waterproof. All windows were removed and replaced with a 6-inch cinder block wall. A Washington security firm wired the warehouse with 20 closed-circuit cameras. The four large doors were equipped with infrared alarms and metal detectors. Armed guards patrolled the empty warehouse long before any of the documents arrived. When they did arrive, they came in unmarked tractor-trailer rigs, complete with more armed guards. Dozens of deliveries were made over a 2-week period in mid-September. The warehouse, nicknamed Fort Rush, came to life as ton after ton of paperwork was stacked neatly in white cardboard boxes, all waiting to be organized into a system understood only by the lawyers up in New York. The warehouse was leased by Scully and Pershing. Every contract was signed by Wilson Rush. Contracts for the renovations, security operations, transporting of documents, everything. Once the documents entered the warehouse, they were deemed AWP, attorney's work product, and thus subject to a different set of rules regarding disclosure to the other side. Mr. Rush selected 10 associates from his litigation team, 10 of the brightest and most trusted. These unlucky souls were shipped to Wilmington and introduced to Fort Rush, a long, windowless hangar of a building with shiny concrete floors and a pungent industrial smell to it. In the center was the mountain of boxes. Along both sides were rows of empty folding tables, and beyond the tables were 10 large, fierce-looking copy machines, with wires and cables running everywhere. The copiers were, of course, state-of-the-art color and capable of instant scanning, collating, even stapling. Far away from their New York offices, the associates were allowed to wear jeans and running shoes, and they were promised bigger bonuses and other goodies. But nothing could compensate them for the dismal job of physically copying and scanning 1 million documents. And in Wilmington, most were married, with spouses and children back home, though of the 10, 4 had already suffered through a divorce. And it was quite likely that Fort Rush would be the cause of even more marital problems. They began their forbidding task under the direction of Mr. Rush himself. Every document was copied twice, in a split second, and instantly scanned into the firm's virtual library. Several weeks down the road, when the task was complete, the library would be accessible by a secured code, and once inside, a lawyer could locate any document in a matter of seconds. The firm's computer experts designed the library and were supremely confident that its security was impenetrable. To impress upon the associates the gravity of their seemingly mindless work, Mr. Rush stayed for 3 days and was involved in the unpacking, sorting, scanning, copying, and repacking. When he left, 2 other litigation partners remained and directed traffic. Such mundane work was normally contracted out to a copying service and supervised by the firm's litigation support staff, but that was far too risky with these documents. They had to be handled by real lawyers who appreciated their importance. The real lawyers manning the copiers averaged about $400,000 in salary, and most had at least 1 degree from an Ivy League school. At no point in their graduate or postgraduate studies could they have pictured themselves running copiers, but after 4 or 5 years with Scully and Pershing, they were shockproof. The rotation began after the first week. 8 days in the warehouse, then 4 days in New York, then back to Wilmington. The assignments were staggered, and a total of 15 associates were eventually used. All were forbidden to discuss any aspect of Fort Rush with anyone in New York. Security and confidentiality were paramount. The first project took 6 weeks. 2.2 million documents were copied, indexed, and added to the library. The associates were freed from Fort Rush and flown back to New York on a chartered jet. By then, Benny knew exactly where the warehouse was located and had a general idea of its security features, but his interest in these matters was only passing. What Benny wanted, of course, was access to the virtual library, access only his spy could deliver. Chapter 20. For another $1,000, the security firm in Pittsburgh watched Elaine Keenan long enough to determine her daily routine. She usually had lunch with some co-workers at a sandwich shop not far from the Parks and Recreation Complex where she worked. A chance encounter would have to be believable, and Joey couldn't sell the idea of bumping into her in the lesbian bar she and her roommate occasionally frequented. He wasn't sure he could sell any encounter with Elaine. Aside from the casual sex 5.5 years earlier, he'd never really known her. She had been one of several groupies around the Beta fraternity, and he tried to forget all of them. The security firm provided 3 color photos. Joey had studied them for hours and was not convinced he'd ever met the girl. Kyle, however, had studied them and claimed to recall her vividly. Now, at the age of 23, her dark hair was tinted a deep red and worn very short. There was no makeup, no lipstick, nothing but matching tattoos around her forearms. If she had any interest in being attractive, it was not apparent. Somewhere under all the attitude was a cute girl, but sex appeal was unimportant. Joey swallowed hard, cursed Kyle again, and entered the sandwich shop. He eased behind her as she waited in line to order, and after a few minutes, as the line moved slowly forward, managed to bump into her.
"Sorry," he quickly said with a wide, fake smile.
She smiled back, but said nothing. He moved a step closer and said,
"Hey, you were at Duquesne a few years ago, weren't you?"
Her two co-workers glanced back, but were not interested. "Briefly," she said, eyeing him carefully, searching for any clue. He snapped his fingers as if trying to recall something.
"Elaine, right? Can't think of the last name."
"That's right. And who are you?"
"Joey Bernardo. I was in Beta."
A look of horror swept over her face, and she dropped her gaze to the floor. For a moment, she was frozen, unable to speak, ready, it seemed, to erupt. Then she shuffled a step to keep pace in line. She turned her back on the man who once raped her, a man who walked away from the crime not only unpunished, but completely vindicated. Joey watched her from the corner of an eye and felt uneasy for several reasons. First, she was obviously frightened by him, but since she considered herself the victim and him the rapist, this was not surprising. It was also uncomfortable being this close to someone he'd once had sex with, regardless of how casual or how uneventful it now seemed. She turned halfway to him and hissed,
"What are you doing here?"
"I'm eating lunch, same as you."
"Would you please leave?"
Her voice was barely audible, but one of her co-workers turned around and glared at Joey.
"No, I'm just getting a sandwich."
Nothing else was said as they ordered and moved down to the pickup counter. Elaine hurried off to a distant table and ate quickly with her two friends. Joey ate alone at a small table near the front door. The note was already prepared. It read,
"Elaine, I'd like to talk to you about what happened. Please call my cell at 412-866-0940. I'll be in Scranton until 9 o'clock tomorrow. Joey Bernardo."
He hauled his tray back to the counter, then walked to her table, handed her the note without a word, and disappeared. 2 hours later, she called. At 5 p.m. sharp, as agreed, Joey returned to the sandwich shop. He found Elaine at the same table she'd used for lunch, but instead of sitting with a couple of friends, she was accompanied by her attorney. Icy introductions were made, and Joey sat down across from them with a knot in his throat and a strong desire to maim Kyle McAvoy. Where the hell was Kyle anyway? He was the lawyer. Elaine's lawyer was an attractive, middle-aged woman. Everything was black: pantsuit, thick coral necklace, boots, eyeshadow, and, worst of all, her mood. This woman went for the throat. The business card Joey was holding and glancing at proclaimed her to be Michelin Mike Chiz, attorney and counselor at law. She began matter-of-factly. "My first question for you, Mr. Bernardo, is what are you doing here?"
"How many questions do you have?"
Joey asked in his finest smart-ass manner. He had been assured time after time by his pseudo-lawyer and near-co-defendant, one Kyle McAvoy, that there was no danger in this chance meeting with Elaine Keenan. Any legal action she wanted to initiate could have been commenced long ago. 5.5 years had passed.
"Well, Mr. Bernardo, may I call you Joey?"
There was almost no chance that she would allow him to call her Mike, so he abruptly said no.
"Very well, Mr. Bernardo. I have just a few questions. I have represented Ms. Keenan here for some time now. She actually works part-time in my office, a fine paralegal, and I'm familiar with her story. Now, what are you doing here?"
"First of all, I don't have to explain a damned thing to you, but I'll try to be nice, at least for the next 60 seconds. I work for a brokerage firm in Pittsburgh, and we have some clients in Scranton. I'm here to see these clients. I got hungry around noon today. I chose this 4-star restaurant at random. Walked in, saw Ms. Keenan here, said hello, she freaked, I wanted to chat, and now I'm taking questions from her lawyer. Why exactly do you need a lawyer, Elaine?"
"You raped me, Joey," Elaine blurted. "You and Baxter Tate, and maybe Kyle McAvoy."
By the time she finished, her eyes were moist. Her breathing was heavy, almost heaving, as if she might lunge at him at any moment.
"Maybe this, maybe that. You never got your story straight."
"Why did you want to talk to my client?"
Ms. Chiz demanded.
Because it was a misunderstanding, and I wanted to apologize for the misunderstanding. That's all. After she cried rape, we never saw her again. The cops investigated, found nothing because nothing happened, and by then Elaine had disappeared.
You raped me, Joey, and you know it.
There was no rape, Elaine. We had sex. Me and you, you and Baxter, you and most of the other boys at Beta. But it was all very consensual. Elaine closed her eyes and began shaking as if chills swept her body. Why does she need a lawyer? Joey asked Ms. Chiz.
She suffered greatly.
I don't know how much she's suffered, Ms. Chiz, but I do know that she suffered very little during her days at Duquesne. She was too busy partying to spend time suffering. Lots of booze, drugs, and sex, and there are lots of boys and girls perfectly capable of refreshing her memory. You'd better get to know your client before you pursue some bogus legal action. There's a lot of bad stuff back there.
Shut up! Elaine snarled. You want to apologize to her? The lawyer said.
Yes. Elaine, I apologize for the misunderstanding, whatever the hell it was. And I think you should apologize for accusing us of something that did not happen. And right now, I want to apologize for even being here. Joey sprang to his feet. This was not a good idea. So long.
He walked quickly out of the deli, strolled to his car, and left Scranton. Driving back to Pittsburgh, when he wasn't cursing Kyle McAvoy, he was hearing her voice again and again.
You raped me, Joey.
Her words were painful and free of doubt. She may not have known precisely what happened in their apartment 5.5 years earlier, but she certainly knew now.
He hadn't raped anyone.
What began as consensual sex, at her suggestion, nonetheless, had now been transformed into something far different, at least in her mind. If a girl consents to sex, can she change her mind once things are underway? Or if she consents to sex, then blacks out halfway through the act, how can she later claim she'd changed her mind? Difficult questions, and Joey wrestled with them as he drove.
You raped me, Joey.
The mere accusation carried a heavy dose of suspicion, and for the first time, Joey questioned himself. Had he and Baxter taken advantage of her? 4 days later, Kyle stopped by the mailroom at Scully and Pershing and picked up a letter from Joey. It was a detailed summary of the encounter, complete with their choice of sandwiches and a description of Elaine's hair color and matching tattoos. After setting out the facts, Joey offered his opinions.
EK has definitely convinced herself that she was raped by several of us, JB and BT for sure, and maybe KM. She is weak, fragile, emotionally unstable, haunted, but at the same time carries a certain smugness in her victimhood. She has chosen the right attorney, a tough broad who believes in her and would not hesitate to start legal trouble if she could find any evidence. Her finger's on the trigger. If that little video is half as damaging as you say it is, then by all human means, keep it locked away from these people. Elaine and her lawyer are two cobras, pissed and coiled and ready to strike.
He finished with,
I'm not sure what my next little project might be, but I'd rather not go near Elaine again. I don't like being called a rapist. The entire episode was unnerving. Plus, I had to lie to Blair to get out of town. I have 2 tickets to the Steelers-Giants game on October 26th. Shall I call you with this news so your goons will know about it? I really think we should go to the game and hash out our next moves. Your faithful servant, Joey.
Kyle read the letter and summary in the main library while hiding between shelves of ancient law books. It confirmed his worst fears, but he had little time to dwell on it. He quietly tore the sheets of paper into 100 pieces, then dropped them in a wastebasket as he left the library. Immediately destroy all written correspondence, he'd instructed Joey. The hotel nearest his apartment was the Chelsea Garden, a 15-minute walk. At 11 that night, Kyle dragged himself along 7th Avenue, looking for the hotel. Had he not been so exhausted, he might have enjoyed the cool autumn night with leaves sweeping across the sidewalk and half the city still awake and going somewhere. But Kyle was numb with fatigue and capable of only one thought at a time, and that was often too much. Benny was in a suite on the 3rd floor, where he'd been waiting for 2 hours because his asset couldn't get away from the office. But Benny didn't mind. His asset belonged at the office, and the more time he spent there, the quicker Benny could get on with his work. Regardless, though, Benny opened up with a nasty, "You're 2 hours late." "Sue me." Kyle stretched out on the bed. This was their fourth meeting in New York since Kyle had moved there, and he had yet to hand over anything that Benny wasn't supposed to have. His ethics were still intact. No laws had been broken. So why did he feel like such a traitor? Benny was tapping a large white poster board mounted on an easel. "If I could have your attention, please," he said. "This won't take long. I have some coffee if you'd like." Kyle wasn't about to concede an inch. He jumped to his feet, poured coffee in a paper cup, and sat on the edge of the bed. "Go. This is the Trilon team as it is now assembled. At the top here is Wilson Rush, and below him are 8 litigation partners, Mason, Bradley, Weems, Cochran, Green, Abbott, Etheridge, and Wittenberg. How many have you met?" Kyle studied the 8 squares with the name scrawled inside them and thought for a second. "Wilson Rush spoke to us during orientation, but I haven't seen him since. I did a memo for Abbott on a securities case, met him briefly, and I had lunch one day in the cafeteria with Wittenberg. I've seen Bradley, Weems, maybe Etheridge, but I can't say I've met them. It's a big firm." Kyle was still amazed at the unknown faces he encountered every day in the halls and elevators, the cafeteria and libraries and coffee rooms. He tried to socialize and at least say hello, but the clock was always ticking, and billing was much more important. His supervising partner was Doug Peckham, and he was relieved Peckham's name was not on the board. There were a bunch of smaller squares under the partners. Benny tapped an index finger near them. "There are 16 senior associates, and under them another 16 younger ones. The names are in that binder over there. You need to memorize them." "Sure, Benny." Kyle glanced at the binder, this one a 2-inch blue one. The last 3 were black and thicker. Then he studied the names on the board. "How many of these associates have you worked with?" 5, 6, maybe 7, he said with no effort at being accurate. How would Benny know whom he'd worked with? And how Benny knew the names of all 41 lawyers assigned to the Trilon case was a question Kyle didn't even want to consider. A few of the names would appear in the court file, but only the big boys. How many sources did he have? He pointed to a smaller box. "This is a senior associate named Sherry Abney. You met her?" "No." "A rising star, fast track to partnership. 2 degrees from Harvard and a federal clerkship. She reports to partner Mason, who's in charge of discovery. Under her is a second-year associate by the name of Jack McDougal. McDougal has a cocaine problem. No one at the firm knows it, but he's about to get busted, so everybody will know it. His departure will be quick." Kyle stared at the box with McDougal's name and thought of so many questions he didn't know where to start. How did Benny know this? "And you want me to take his place?" "I want you to schmooze it up with Sherry Abney. Check her out. Get to know her. She's 30 years old, single, but committed to an investment banker at Chase who works as many hours as she does, so they have no time for any fun. No wedding date, as of now, at least nothing that has been announced. She likes to play squash when she can find the time, and as you know, the firm has 2 courts on the 40th floor beside the gym. You play squash?" "I guess I do now." Kyle had played several times at Yale. "Not sure when I'll find the time." "You figure it out. She just might be your entree onto the Trilon team." Go, team, go. Kyle planned to avoid Trilon and its litigation team as diligently as possible. "Small problem here, Benny," Kyle said. "Nice homework, but you're missing the obvious. There are no first-year grunts anywhere near this case. A couple of reasons. First, we don't know anything. 5 months ago, we were still in law school. And second, the smart boys at Trilon probably told their lawyers to keep the rookies away from this case. That happens, you know. Not all of our clients are stupid enough to pay $300 an hour for a bunch of kids to stick it to them. So, Benny, where is Plan B?" "It takes patience, Kyle. And politics. You start angling for the Trilon case, networking with the upper associates, kissing the right asses, and we might get a lucky break. Kyle wasn't finished with the discussion about McDougal. He was determined to pursue it, when another man suddenly appeared from the sitting room adjacent to the bedroom. Kyle was so startled he almost dropped the half-filled cup of coffee. "This is Nigel," Benny was saying. "He'll spend a few minutes on systems." Nigel was in his face, thrusting forward a hand to shake. "A pleasure," he sang in a cheery British way. He then moved to the tripod and mounted his own display. The sitting room was 12 by 12. Kyle looked through the open double doors into it. Nigel had been hiding in there and listening to every word. "Scully and Pershing uses a litigation support system called Jurybox," he began quickly. All movements were rapid and precise. British, but with a strange accent. 40 years old, 5 feet 10 inches, 150 pounds. Short, dark hair, half gray. Eyes, brown. No remarkable features, but slightly elevated cheekbones. Thin lips. No eyeglasses.
"How much have they taught you about jury books?"
Nigel wanted to know. "The basics. I've used it on several occasions." Kyle was still reeling from Nigel's unexpected appearance.
"It's your typical litigation support system. All discovery is scanned into a virtual library that can be accessed by all lawyers working on the case. Quick retrieval of documents. Super quick search of keywords, phrases, contract language, anything really. You're up to speed?"
"Yes."
"It's fairly secure. Pretty standard stuff these days. And like all smart law firms, Scully also uses a more secure system for sensitive files and cases. It's called Bannister. You in on this one?"
"No."
"Not surprised. They keep it quiet. Works pretty much like Jury Box, but much harder to access or to hack into. Keep your ears open for it."
Kyle nodded as if he would do precisely as he was being told. Since February, on that awful night when he'd been ambushed after a youth league basketball game on the cold streets of New Haven, he had met only with Benny Wright, or whoever he really was. He had assumed, without really thinking about it, that Benny, as his handler, would be the only face of the operation. There were other faces, to be sure. In particular, a couple of the street pounders who followed him night and day and who'd made enough mistakes so that Kyle could now spot them. But it had not occurred to him that he would actually be introduced to someone else with a bogus name who worked for the operation. And why was he? Benny was certainly capable of handling Nigel's little presentation.
"And then you have the Trilon case,"
Nigel was singing.
"A completely different matter, I'm afraid. Much more complicated and secure. Whole different batch of software, really. Probably written just for this one lawsuit. Got the docs locked up in a warehouse down south with Uzis at every door. But we've made progress."
He stopped long enough to allow himself a quick approving smile at Benny. "Aren't we clever?"
"We know that the program is codenamed Sonic, as in B-10 Hypersonic Bomber."
"Not very creative, if you ask me. But then they didn't, did they?
Ha ha. Sonic cannot be accessed by the nice little laptop they gave you greenies on day one.
No, sir.
No laptop can have a peek at Sonic."
Nigel bounced to the other side of the tripod.
"There is a secret room on the 18th floor of your building, heavily secured, mind you, with a bank of desktop computers, some really fancy stuff. And there is where you will find Sonic. Passcodes change every week, passwords every day, sometimes twice a day. Must have the proper ID before logging in, and if you log out without quitting to a T, they'll write you up and maybe show you the door."
"Show me the door," Kyle almost said.
"Sonic is probably a bastardized version of Bannister, so it will be incumbent upon you to master Bannister as soon as you're given the opportunity."
"Can't wait," Kyle almost said. Slowly, through the shock and the fatigue, it was sinking in that Kyle was crossing the line, and doing it in a way he had not envisioned. His nightmare was to walk out of Scully and Pershing with secrets he was not supposed to have, and deliver them like Judas to Benny for 30 pieces of silver. Now, though, he was receiving firm secrets from an outside source. He had yet to steal anything, but he damned sure wasn't supposed to know about Sonic and the hidden room on the 18th floor. Perhaps it wasn't criminal, and maybe it wasn't a violation of the canons of ethics, but it certainly felt wrong. "That's enough for now," Benny was saying. "You look exhausted. Get some rest." "Oh, thank you." Back on 7th Avenue, Kyle glanced at his watch. It was almost midnight. Chapter 21. At 5 a.m., the usual hour now, the alarm clock exploded at full volume, and Kyle slapped it twice before it shut off. He hurried through the shower and the shave, and 15 minutes later he was on the sidewalk, fashionably dressed because he could certainly afford fine clothes. His life had quickly become a harried, fatigued mess, but he was determined to look nice as he stumbled through the day. He bought a coffee, a bagel, and a copy of the Times at his favorite all-night deli, then caught a cab at the corner of 24th and 7th. 10 minutes later, he'd finished breakfast, scanned the newspaper, and gulped half the coffee. He walked into the Broad Street entrance of his office building at 6 o'clock, on schedule. Regardless of the hour, he was never alone during the elevator ride up. There were usually two or three other bleary-eyed and gaunt-faced associates, all sleep-deprived, all avoiding eye contact as the elevator hummed and rocked gently upward, and they asked themselves several questions. What was I thinking when I chose law school? How long will I last in this meat grinder? What fool designed this method of practicing law? There was seldom a word because there was nothing to say. Like prisoners riding to the gallows, they chose to meditate and put things in perspective. At the Cube, Kyle was not surprised to see another young lawyer. Tim Reynolds had been the first to sneak in a sleeping bag, a new, thermally insulated Eddie Bauer special that he claimed he'd owned for years and taken all over the country. But it had a new smell to it. Tim, without shoes, tie, shirt, or jacket, and wearing an old T-shirt, was partially curled under his small desk, inside the sleeping bag, dead to the world. Kyle kicked his feet, woke him up, and began with a pleasant, "You look like crap."
"Good morning,"
Tim said, scrambling to his feet and reaching for his shoes.
"What time is it?"
6:10.
"What time did you go to sleep?"
"I don't remember. Sometime after 2. He was pulling on his shirt quickly, as if a dreaded partner might appear any second and issue demerits. "I have a memo due for Toby Rowland at 7, and I have no idea what I'm doing." "Just keep billing," Kyle said without a trace of sympathy as he unpacked his briefcase and pulled out his laptop. Tim finished dressing and grabbed a file.
"I'll be in the library,"
he said, already a wreck.
"Don't forget to brush your teeth," Kyle said.